Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison monthly meeting. And our speaker today is Susan Hagstrom.
We're going to discuss religious favoritism in the workplace and issues with that. And I mean discuss. I'm going to pretty much set up a bunch of questions and I want discussion. Okay, so the term religious liberty is the phrase most evangelicals use to pursue their designs, particularly in court. On the website for the American Center for Law and Justice, they use the phrase, quote, working to protect religious and constitutional freedoms in the courts, in Congress, and in the public arena, unquote. The next two paragraphs detail court cases designed to break the separation of church and state and to work to make these actions worldwide for evangelicals. At the Supreme Court of the United States, this is a quote, Jay Sokolow has argued 12 cases, including several landmark cases that have become part of the legal landscape in the area of religious liberty litigation. In the Mergens case, Jay Sokolow cleared the way for public school students to form Bible clubs and religious organizations on their school campuses. In the Lamb's Chapel case, he defended the free speech rights of religious groups, ensuring that they be treated equally with respect to the use of public facilities. In McConnell versus FEC, Jay Sokolow ensured that the constitutional rights of young people remain protected with a unanimous decision by the High Court guaranteeing that minors can participate in political campaigns. Most recently, in Pleasant Grove City versus Summon, he secured a unanimous First Amendment decision clearing the way for governments to accept permanent monuments of their choosing, including 10 commandment monuments in public parks. At the beginning, no one could have predicted what began as a mission to protect religious liberty in this country would involve an international outreach. In a world where Christians face discrimination, violence, and even death for practicing their faith, it soon became clear that there was work to be done abroad. Jay Sokolow believes that religious liberty, religious freedom, is an international right, a global concern. And he basically founded areas in France. He's got location in Russia, Kenya, Zimbabwe, Pakistan, and Israel. We even have it in Wisconsin. A new bill in the Wisconsin legislature includes a constitutional amendment with the amendment, quote, the right of conscience, which includes the right to engage in activity or refrain from activity based on a sincerely held religious belief, shall not be burdened unless the state proves it as a compelling interest in infringing upon the specific action of refusal to act. And the burden is the least restrictive alternative to the state's action. A burden to the right of conscience includes indirect burdens, such as withholding benefits, assessing penalties, or exclusion from programs or access to facilities. Religious liberty again. Throughout the past year, from Sandra Flew's defense of contraception as a benefit to a congregational session only willing to discuss the issue with male religionists, to more and more cases where court cases asking for defense of religious liberty, to a lack of faith being a poor risk indicator to cause loss of life or diminished functioning in the U.S. Marines. The arguments have been almost entirely in the religious liberty category. Americans as a group are all for religious liberty. So the first question would be, how do humanists defend religious liberty while still protecting the separation of church and state? Anybody got an opinion?
I keep thinking as you were reading that, what would they do if we substituted atheist, you substituted Muslim, you know, that in terms of rights, that they're so hardy in their defense of people who don't agree with them having the liberty to speak and act. I was reading that amendment this morning and I said, this is very badly written. I have no idea what they're trying to say. And Bob said, that's probably the
point. Yeah, that's the point, yeah.
I think, Susan,
I'll just get
humanist, I would try to look at what am I pushing legislatively for human needs, rather than defending everyone's right to have their own religion and practice it any way they want. I think if we began to, and humanists try to do that, you know, what do human beings need from each other, what do they need basic human needs versus the viewpoint of humanism needs to be put there with every other viewpoint.
I will say that in researching this in the web, one of the best arguments I came across unfortunately sounded an awful lot like a conservative could tackle it on the point of being socialist, but it was discussed that every law, every action is essentially a collective action. We do not go and run red lights because, I mean, we have basically decided that we're going to stop at the red light. We don't necessarily do it because we're worried about police. People have sat down and said some sort of thought in their brains, this is a law that makes some sense, we're going to stop this red light. And they sort of collectively have done that. So that is where the freedom of from religion and the freedom from separation of church and state sort of come in. I sort of like that argument the best. Because essentially what this religious liberty argument is doing is clicking people. Clicking. You know, like those cliques in school, high school that are supposed to do in really
it's
bad high school movies. Yeah.
Well, the rules are that any religion can exercise its rights as long as it's ours.
Right to worship Almighty God. Okay, this isn't written for me.
Well, I mean, if you read both sides of the things, and I was reading, you know, the websites for the American Center of Law and Justice, which is a religious right as far as you can go, it almost sounds like, you know, for every side the Americans United and Freedom from Religion wins, they win another one. It's just like this huge duke 'em out session in the courts. Let's go for question number two. From 1992 to 2012, there has been a roughly 36% increase in religious discrimination cases from 1,388 in 1992 to 3,811 in 2012. The highest number was in 2011, 4,151. Reported at the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, EEOC. Given no differentiation between accommodations of beliefs versus discrimination, that's still an awfully large increase. How about we discuss methods for alleviating this? What is the cause? Is it this religious liberty of the right again? And, well, the whys of it.
Are all these cases brought by Christian fundamentalists? Or
no, the Equal Opportunities Commission does not differentiate.
I didn't think so. So. We don't know. Maybe the uptick is Muslims saying that they're being discriminated against.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, there's a huge selection. Yeah, yeah. And I point out, Christopher Hitchens once wrote in an article for Free Inquiry of prayer circles at Deloitte and Touch, and being on a discussion panel where the, quote, spirituality, unquote, of Ben & Jerry's ice cream was praised. But you didn't know that one. Ooh. So, There are actually books out there on Amazon.com.
Jerry Garcia was reading.
Huh? Yeah.
I just say Jerry Garcia just sounds very spiritual to me.
There are articles out there on the web and books out there on Amazon.com discussing the spirituality index of businesses. You can get your business rated spirituality-wise. Mm. So, you know, I mean, how much is too much of this?
Is that likely to be from a Christian perspective?
You can get sort of a Christian's perspective, and then they have some that are, they quote, non-religious. So they will discuss all sorts of varieties.
Oh, they're haunted. Oh.
I mean, in terms of this business thing, if you read Christopher Hitchens, he's been battling, you know, Muslim prayer mats as well as, you know, Christian prayer circles. So it's gotten around and, you know, so it's, you know, it's probably equal. If you read the websites, it's probably, I mean, almost equal to the people who want to defend their religious beliefs and be able to go off and have a prayer mat, Muslim prayer mat session versus the boss from hell who says you're going from Satan because you don't believe in religion. And, you know, I mean, Christopher Hitchens, at least in one article, he does mention a working with a lady who got fired because, actually quit because she couldn't stand her boss's religion. So, well, what do you think? Do we support the people who want to express their religious beliefs? If we do, how do we prevent the discrimination?
Are there any active lawsuits where the Americans, for separation of churches that are involved?
With that particular group, most of them just, most of the time they just do what they call amicus briefs, which is just basically an argument supporting one side or the other. He recently did one in New Mexico supporting a photographer who refused to photograph a same-sex marriage. New Mexico is right on the line. They sort of don't permit it and don't prohibit it as well.
I'm looking at the, or thinking about the issues associated with the Affordable Health Care Act. Specifically exempts religious employers from some of the requirements for universal health care coverage. So the rights and benefits available to employees of a religious organization can, by that organization, be restricted. The definition of what's a religious organization has become very problematic. Hobby Lobby says, we are a religious organization because we, as owners of the organization, hold these religious beliefs. Therefore, we should be able to apply that to the coverage available for our employees.
So that means certain religion gets
the
benefits, and certain religions don't get
that. Let's go for the range of the organizations. A church is clearly a religious organization and has employees, and there are rights in the Affordable Health Care Act for them to restrict coverage. We're talking specifically about reproductive rights coverage.
So no employee can get it, or just
if that church decides that no employee can get it, and that's legal under the law. But Hobby Lobby, that's a commercial business, the owners have a suit that will be heard by the Supreme Court this year, saying they too should be able to restrict the availability of reproductive services under their insurance policies, coverage for their employees, because of their religious beliefs. So the organization per se is not a religious organization under the tax cuts. It's a commercial organization. Now, in between, there are associations of churches, the statewide synod, that is probably under the law legitimately defined as a religious organization, and therefore that right of discrimination applies to them. But you move into other organizations that are requesting it are hospitals, the hospitals which are religiously affiliated, colleges that are religiously affiliated. And so where is the definition of discrimination because we are in fact a religious organization and that's our belief and that's our structure, and we ask our employees and require our employees to accept those restrictions as part of the healthcare coverage, to an organization that's providing other kinds of services that are not per se religious services, but let's move into the colleges, a college that is clearly a religious instruction organization, even though they provide a liberal arts degree, let's say, or an engineering degree. Are they legitimately discriminating or not?
So in theory, this Supreme Court ruling will help put a, will make that line crystal clear, but so it could be that, or it could be they just say, in Hobby Lobby's case, we think you're full of it, but not solve all of the other
ones. Right, narrowly defined or broadly.
Yeah.
Yeah, have to do something like look into the mission platform for the company to find out if they actually in that state that their goal is to spread the word. Or,
well, it seems like though
they have to have a Christian mission and goal as a company to be able to be exempt.
They are a for-profit organization and they do pay taxes like a for-profit. It seems like that's a distinction you
right,
can make.
Right.
I think that'd be probably really very interesting legal distinction.
I mean, somehow the IRS knows how to determine which is which.
The case law on corporations is that you must make money if you're a for-profit corporation. The money is the highest goal. And so,
that's true. Not
religious proselytization shouldn't be part of the picture.
For me, also, if you consider healthcare a basic human right, then it's discriminating against all people because we all deserve that service. And I think arguments should be from that point of view. It has nothing to do with a person's religion, etc. The issue is, does that person deserve healthcare? The answer is yes, but it doesn't matter what kind of institution you have. You're required. You're a bona fide organization in the United States of America, you have to provide the level of healthcare that you're going to have to be completely efficient.
That's one thing that cannot come out of that decision.
I personally go so far as to say every organization providing health care should provide a policy that provides the minimum levels that are prescribed by the Affordable Health Care Act.
Which includes
and it's up to the individual and their employer to decide whether the person will take advantage of those benefits or not. But the law specifically exempts religious organizations. Now,
in case you might possibly want to discriminate against people, you can.
What if my religion is money?
Yes, it is.
Doesn't count under the tax code.
Then you do well as a corporation.
Unless you're the 1%, and then it does.
Yeah, because if I give benefits to my employees, that takes away from my bottom line, and that's my religion.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that falls in the tax code's definition of religion.
Okay.
Our approach is the licenses.
Yeah.
Get the Koch brothers.
Licenses that the state grants, for example, the pharmacists. I don't think there should be any religious exemption
or someone who accepts a state license as a pharmacist to deny any part of that normal medical care on drugs and whatever provided.
You'll be out of luck on that one if this amendment goes through. Goldsmith has said that is one of his purposes in putting that amendment together.
Right, except that the amendment talks about that it be granted unless there was, I forget quite how they put it, it's kind of like it, unless there was no other alternative. Well, if you're out in the middle of North Dakota and you only have one pharmacy within 200 square miles, there does not seem to me that there's a logical alternative.
Yeah, but you hand me the prescription and I hand it back and say, I'm sorry, we're closed now.
Which is what happens.
Yeah.
Especially the things that are time sensitive, like the contraceptive,
Well, the other issue that is it's the Wisconsin Amendment, and if you go up north, huge portion of the hospitals up there are all run by a group which they don't automatically advertise themselves as Christian, but their back company, their huge company, is a Christian organization, so they're seriously out of luck up north when it comes to that sort of thing.
You know, when birth control first came out, pharmacists, it was never an issue. I mean, you just gave them out. I mean, since when?
It's become an issue.
I mean, why did it become? Well,
I mean,
that's a good question. Why did it become an issue?
Yeah. I think upon reading about these things,
it became an issue because a substantial number of people felt they were being discriminated against, and they reacted
by having to buy it for their employees.
Right, for having to buy it or deliver the prescription or whatever.
But I mean. Okay.
Well, if I lived in a community that required me to have a gun in
my home,
I would want to violate that law.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. So I can see why individuals say you're requiring me to do things that are against my conscience.
How do you get to be against people's conscience?
Right.
Yeah.
That's the real question.
Yeah.
But
because when it first came out, it was seen as preventing unwanted pregnancies and abortion.
I personally think it's almost a fabricated thing. The groups that are picking these discrimination cases, especially with the affordable health care. Another example here is Eden Foods from Michigan, which is an organic foods group. They're also doing it. They're, according to AU, they're basing their lawsuit on the 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act, whatever that one is, I don't know that one.
So
you get that, and then you get Hobby Lobby. They're both quite large organizations, which will impact a lot of employees.
Yeah.
You don't see them doing these lawsuits for teeny weeny little two-person stores.
Yeah.
What about the issue that's in the news right now about a pastor who has been urging the members of the congregation not to immunize their children, and they have spawned a measles epidemic. All right, and there's a substantial amount of criticism of the pastor and the group, the congregation, for taking this stance. The issue of religious freedom comes into play. The issue of protecting the population of children comes into play. And at what point, let's add another one. There's a headline today about a family in Oregon that is praying for their daughter with diabetes, and she's dying. And of course, the state is intervening in that. And so the rights of society, the rights of the children, take precedence in many instances, and the courts have ruled that that's the case. And so if we're talking about contraceptives, the rights of the patient to receive that filled prescription are said to take precedence over the religious beliefs of the pharmacist. And that's where the argument is. But the pharmacists are saying, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that. My feeling is they should get a better job if they can.
Perhaps a lot of that goes back, with the children, goes back to the idea of children as possessions.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Rather than as an individual. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what isn't all that long ago that children were legally possessions of their parents.
And that was in child abuse if they were disciplined, corporal punishment.
Absolutely. But it was perfectly all right because the children were like little slaves, possessions of their parents. Until they reach stage of majority. And, you know, so in like the case with the child with diabetes, the parents are not looking at it, the child has no say. Or even if they do, they're reflecting the parents' viewpoint. You know, then if the state intervenes, they're intervening on behalf of the child who isn't recognizing that they are a separate person. But you don't have to go back very far in history to see children treated as possessions of their parents.
It seems like other people would have an interest in having your children immunized so their property doesn't get injured by catching measles from your child.
Or if you haven't had them.
Yeah, even more.
Well, back.
I guess you get immunized. 70% of the population has to be immunized. There's a critical number.
Herd immunity.
And herd immunity, right. And we're actually, as a country, we're teetering right on that edge right now. Where if people keep going with this trend, well, you know, immunize the herd, and then my child doesn't have to be immunized.
Right.
Well, if people do that, and like I say, right now, statistically, we're hovering right on the edge of that herd immunity where there isn't enough, there aren't enough children immunized to protect the unimmunized.
And we have a very large number of well-educated young parents who believe that you shouldn't immunize your children.
They're afraid
non-religious reasons.
They're afraid of autism, you know.
That's something.
That guy in England who's been totally debunked, but, you know, they're trying to be conscientious of parents, and they believe it, and they don't immunize.
And that's become, if you will, a religion.
Yeah, in that sense, yeah. And so because of this, and it isn't, as Al said, it isn't the uneducated necessarily, and it isn't the religious necessarily, but it's going to end up in disaster.
But let's go back to the workplace. Christmas decorations. And everyone's saying Merry Christmas to one another at the office party in late December. I personally felt very much discriminated against. And I know that my coworkers who were non-Christian, members of other religious traditions, really felt discriminated against.
Why did you take it so seriously? In this case, religion is apparently, just how you phrase it, in this situation, religion was an important idea to get upset about. And I'm thinking perhaps we need to defuse the importance of religion by saying, what the hell? Let them do whatever they want to do, and I'm here.
Oh, that was ultimately what I...
I'm being kind of a devil's advocate.
Yeah, no, it's ultimately what I did. But it would... The disease would come on to me during the season because it was so blatant as we're turning this public employment office into a religious organization. Religious symbolism was posted everywhere.
So it was a divide and conquer kind of thing.
Yeah.
But when the real irony is, it's the Christian people that ought to be upset by the commercialization of their religious holiday. I mean, they're the ones that ought to be up in arms saying, you know, give me my religious holiday back, you know. Madison Avenue,
keep away,
yeah.
And to give them the credit of the doubt, if you actually just talk to some really Christian people, they will be admit to being fairly upset about the commercial.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, I know that, but I mean...
not these rightist types, but...
Yeah.
Now, I actually know what he means. One time I just made the innocent comment to two fellow workers that if Scott Walker were to call it a holiday to you again, he would include so many more people. And one person started blasting me with the case of FFRF and how naughty they were, and the next person told me every single thing for 20 minutes what their church was doing for Christmas. So in their own way, they sort of reacted, you know, these are halfway decent people, and they, in their own way, they reacted negatively to the notion of being inclusive.
Well, and if they're talking about what their church is doing, that's just fine.
Yeah.
As opposed to what the state does, which is something else again.
Mm-hmm. But that, I mean, in a way, that was just sort of, you know, sort of backing off. I like Christmas. Enough of this inclusive crap, sort of thing.
With regard to this constitutional amendment, don't you think that our present constitution has adequate protections for religious freedom in Wisconsin?
Oh, it does. If you read the whole amendment, it's quite sufficient. This is, I think this particular amendment here is really a loophole to let all these people do their stuff.
Essentially,
and to be quite honest, every single freedom from religion type organization, ACL, you and everybody else thinks it's about the same thing too. Mm-hmm.
So it's essentially it would establish special privileges for the traditional Christians.
Well, actually, technically speaking, it could be for any religion. They're opening the door. A Muslim's going to use this one just to do anything they want to Muslim-wise.
Oh, yeah, be careful what you wish for, huh?
Yeah. And that is an issue. If you look at the international news for years, France, Belgium, and other places have been having serious issues with Muslims in the workplace wanting their religious freedom to be the thing.
Yeah, it's hard to understand from our viewpoint why in France they were prohibiting people from wearing headscarves due to their religion. And we look at that and go, huh? What's your problem?
Well, the issue has to do with recognizing the person based upon facial characteristics and the disguise. I mean, that was the issue more than it was of religious freedom, but the result was that they were infringing upon religious freedom.
Well, I wasn't being purpose, I was being just a headscarf.
Oh.
The hijabs. They were saying women couldn't wear them.
I thought you meant burqas.
No. France, you could not wear them.
Well, the other thing is, I mean,
it was also illegal.
Probably, I don't know. Is it?
Never happened.
It's a major security risk. Burqa could be anything. Could be an elephant under there.
With the burqa, yeah.
The bomb.
So a habit could be a penguin.
In this case, the reason France and the government was saying, what the rationale was?
They had a huge amount of complaints about them.
The Muslims abusing Muslimness?
Combination of that and a combination of the Muslim was predominantly immigrants and they were not doing a tremendously good job of melding with the rest of the population.
But France wasn't doing a very good job of opening their doors.
They did a really good job of opening the doors.
Well,
they just didn't provide once they got there.
Well, and if you were first, second, third generation, you still weren't considered French.
Well, who is?
We're
French.
Just because you were born in France and lived in France all your life, you were still not considered.
The other issue is it does come down to a sort of similar issue as to, in a way, as to the affordable health care thing you was talking about. The women's outfits, the burqa, the headscarves, etc., are to some degree religious, but also a good portion cultural. If you go way back, women were, before the Islamic religion, women were serious trophies more than people. And to this day, there's more of a cultural thing that, you know, if you show your hair, et cetera, you're being extra sexualized. It's equivalent to the old one, you know, in the 18th, 19th centuries where women were not supposed to show their legs around the Christians, you know, because those legs, those nether limbs were all very sexual.
No.
Yes.
Oh, God.
So, I mean,
brothers around the piano legs.
And a high respect is cultural, so a lot of the French government is sort of arguing that the headscarves, etc., is more of a cultural, sort of anti-sexual sort of thing versus the religious thing, and a lot of these Muslims are arguing the other way around. So you have these, you know, ups and downs on the lawsuit with the two topics.
On the Healthcare Act, my criteria for where you could discriminate in the coverage that the employee can receive must only be allowed if you as an employer are allowed to have that belief as a requirement for employment.
Like a church.
Yeah,
they say,
like we will only hire someone who does not believe that you should receive an abortion, period, and that it's okay for your health insurance not to cover abortion services.
Well, then don't they get into trouble with the equal employment opportunity?
Then only particular types of employees in churches that are there, it's allowed. And so that definition is the definition that I would apply to the Affordable Health Care Act as to whether you can deny coverage for any service in the mandated
setting. Conceivable that could have a two-tiered system in, say, Catholic Charities organization.
Right. Okay. If they cannot require that of their employee, then they cannot, in my mind, discriminate in the workplace on the insurance company that's provided.
And
that's my threshold.
It's a good one, but unfortunately, if you do read the American Defense Law, et cetera, American Center for Law and Justice, they are really working on chopping down those sort of areas. So they're trying to make it so that those religious groups, the faith-based groups, which are trying to do, you know, social justice and collecting money out of the faith-based sections, can only hire people of their own religion. So, I mean, there's been several lawsuits down south about, you know, not other religionists trying to do some welfare jobs, you know, social workers, et cetera, and not, you know, being hired by these guys simply because of their religion or non-religion or being a gay or a lesbian or sort of thing.
Discrimination is important.
So they're really working, I mean, this group is really working on chopping down that gray area.
And so my point is, if you can't discriminate in employment, you also cannot discriminate in healthcare coverage.
Very good logical.
That's the problem with it.
It's too bad it's not in there.
Period.
I know her daughter in Illinois was working with a adoption and foster care system that was within a Christian religion. And when she was initially interviewed, she was asked if she believed in Jesus Christ, her Lord and Savior. And she said, no, I don't, but it's not going to impact my work. And she said she actually used the, I believe, the inherent worth and dignity of each human person. So she said she actually gave me a little talk about what new realism was. And they said, oh, okay. But, you know, I was surprised that they could even bring up
the question.
Yeah.
And they actually, in their training orientation, talked about the whole, it is our responsibility as Christians to find homes for these babies and children and take care of them. But she said it was, the thoughts were good. They were just definitely linked to, it's our Christian responsibility.
So then did they restrict the adoptive parents that they were looking in?
Ooh.
I don't know.
To require them to be Christians.
Randy and I ran into that. we're trying to get.
An amusing note, I lost my cat the other month, and I got a note just yesterday from Veterinarians for Christ Mission.
Whoa.
Why?
And it said that my vet for that lost cat had sent a donation in the cat's name.
Wow.
To Veterinarians for Christ Mission. And I was first startled and first like, okay.
My cat's turning over in her
so
grave.
You need to send a note to your vet saying, and in response to your donation to, I have made a donation to the Freedom from Religion Foundation.
I've matched.
I've doubled.
I could do that, but they didn't tell me the amount, so I don't know that much.
Yeah.
How much was your cat?
I think for me, it's brought this conversation very relevant because I think that most people just want an answer. And they don't necessarily want a particular religion for the answer. But they go through the conventional religion to get an answer for what do I do about abortion, birth control, taxes, whatever. I'll go to my church or at least the religious work of media to get some answers. We have a pension of looking for many answers and coming up with one that best suits us. And I think that's a lot of work for most people to go, or even the democratic process is a lot of work for most people. And I think that becomes an issue for a parent who gets all this information from the religious right about immunization or whatever. And you're sitting there as a parent getting 400 things to do. Oh, I'll just pick one and go that way. Rather than sift them out and say, okay, this is the best thing for my kid. My sense is some of them, unfortunately, kind of knee-jerk, okay, I'm going to go with what that particular internet source told me to do.
Oh, I mean, you're quite right about that. You look at the Focus on the Family website. They almost have it listed as what you can do if your kid does this problem or that problem or the other problem. And it's never more than 3 or 4 paragraphs. And it's sort of quite simple, bang, bang, bang. So you're sort of quite right. And a lot of people probably just go for a really simple answer. And if you think about the title, Focus on the Family, there's no sort of even hint of religion in that. I mean, the whole group is an evangelical right religion, but when you come to the term, it's just the same as this lawyer using the term religious liberty, but pretty much only supporting the Christians' religious liberty and nobody else's religious liberty at all.
And if you really look more closely, it's only the fundamentalists.
Yeah, well,
I think
they're the only ones that are
true. At least with the issue of immunization, I think one of the main problems is there isn't a good solid source of information that parents have to make those decisions on. And I mean, there are some real pros to immunization, but there's also some major cons to immunization. And the AMA or whoever, you know, the extension service for the AMA needs to at least address those issues and concerns which are being addressed by the producers of these products, and there's constant change and improvement going on. But there's a lot of really simple things that could be done. For example, postponing, breaking the immunizations down into tinier amounts, starting them later. A child at 2 months old does not have an immune system. A child at 3 months old doesn't really have an immune system. So if you're pumping, you know, some form of virus or bacterial stimulation for them to develop antibodies against it, they couldn't develop an antibody if they wanted to. So I think it's important to say, well, sure, that this could be postponed till 3 to 4 months. The chance of a baby getting tetanus, I mean, up until the baby's 6 months old, how is it going to get tetanus unless someone's leaving it in a pen with a dog in the backyard? I mean, it could happen, but...
Yeah.
It's unlikely, and I think what happens is parents get a little scared is because they start immunizing babies at 2 months old. That 2 and 3 months old, they go in and they have this list of, here's the 15 immunizations your child's getting at 1 month, 3 months, 5 months, 7 months, and then they start reading maybe immunizations aren't good, and it's like, gee whiz, you know? And I mean, you can. I mean, we use that system with our kids. We have them start later and give very diluted amounts to, you know, work them up to make sure they didn't have a response, an allergic reaction to it. But you could present those as alternatives, and that would give parents the feeling that they were making a decision, that they had some
control.
Yeah.
Well, and I wonder too how much the non-immunized has to do with a lack of insurance to pay for.
Well, sure. Well, no, because most immunizations you can get free.
Well, I know you can get some free, but yeah.
I think, you know, I have a person in my family who's chosen to not immunize their children, and boy, I'll tell you, you sit down with her, and you better have read the textbooks, you better understand every single disease, every immunization, how and why it's given, how it reacts in the body, because there she's informed.
Mm-hmm.
She knows exactly what the tissue response is, and she knows exactly what the pros and cons are for every one of them. It's not like she's just randomly said, I'm not immunizing my child. She's made very careful, thoughtful decisions that she felt were important to make. But, you know, I think for her, for a lot of people, it's pretty heavily weighted. If you're questioning whether or not you want to do immunization, most of the information you're going to find on the web is going to be why you shouldn't do it. There's not a lot of equally readable, easy to understand information being presented on the pro side.
And it certainly isn't that it never backfires. I mean, the federal government has a fund to pay for children who end up being brain damaged.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of immunizations, acknowledging that there's sort of the sacrificial lambs.
There is a risk.
I've treated one of those kids.
But admit that it's there. Be honest with parents and admit there's a risk.
And so some people, I think they fall into two camps. And one camp is this one, really thoughtful people who said, okay, there are all these risks and I'm not putting my child in the position of becoming the sacrificial lamb. Let somebody else do it.
Part of it that was going to what Randy said about wanting to get answers. And a problem with the scientific method and the research is there is too much information to process by yourself. And so we are so dependent on editors of some type, not necessarily in the sense of publication editors, but those that are helping us to find the information that we want. And part of the discrimination in the workplace question comes back to religious pressures to defund sciences in so many places. Because if you will, we don't want to know the answer. Or we don't trust science. We only trust Bronze Age literature in one particular book as interpreted by our clergy providing the answers. And so Henry Ford said history is bunk. There are a lot of religious personages that basically say science is bunk and don't trust those scientists.
So how do these people that get their kids in school, are these the people that are homeschooling their kids?
No, there's an exemption in the law.
You can just...
You
don't have to have a religious reason, you don't
have
to...
No, you just have to have
a religious reason.
And so that
so
stage,
would they had to drag
out
a taro in to get his fifth measles?
The requirement is you can't be admitted into elementary school without having immunization.
Mm-hmm.
Has immunization or parents' declaration that they don't want their children immunized.
So at that point,
so
you weed out the people who just haven't gotten around to it versus the people who have actively decided not to immunize.
Okay.
But it is written, there's an exemption written in the law.
Because they made it sound like we had to have him in for his third
MMR
shot.
It's very strong within the homeschooling community.
Oh, okay.
I mean, there are a lot of people who, that is one of their decision points.
One of the public school things they want to keep the kids away from.
Yeah, it is.
question number three. This is sort of half a question, half a example. To my mind, you want an example of how horrible it would be if the United States became a Christian nation with everything going Christian. The current action in the military is an excellent example.
Yeah.
Paper written by Jay Parco for the Free Inquiry and the Military Religious Freedom Foundation quotes, talking on the Army's spiritual assessment test. Quote, in 2009, the U.S. Army unveiled a $125 million, quote, holistic fitness, unquote, program intended to address the growing issue with post-traumatic stress disorder cases. The online assessment tool included in the program assessed a soldier's spiritual fitness by using questions written predominantly for soldiers who believe in God or another deity. Many non-believers are guaranteed to score poorly and will be forced to participate in exercises that use religious imagery to train soldiers up to a satisfactory level of spirituality. And then in another portion of the paper, he writes, an informal study was conducted in 2010 with groups of officers from across the military services using an oath of equal character. Although the oath was originally authored from a Christian's perspective, one could substitute their own belief set as applicable. Simply put, the oath is as followed. I am a Christian. I will not use my position to influence individuals or the chain of command to adopt Christianity, because I believe that soldiers who are not Christians are just as trustworthy, honorable, and good as those who are. Their standards are as high as mine. Their integrity is beyond reproach. They will not lie, cheat, or steal, and they will not fail when called upon to serve. I trust them completely and without reservation. They can trust me in exactly the same way. So with this informal study, 35% of mid-grade military officers admitted they could never affirm the oath because it isn't true.
35%?
Yes. And with over half of the Army chaplain would-be's, applicants, shall we put it, coming from religious fundamentalist groups, the situation is not likely to get better. And while I admire people fighting this discrimination, if you ever get a chance to listen to Mikey Weinstein, he is woo-hoo. I'm not certain I could cope well in this situation at all. When I read about the right wanting a Christian nation, this mess is what I look at and I shudder. Most people I talk to think that combating this entrenched mindset is so difficult it is not worth attempting. So my question is, what can an average individual do?
In the military or in general?
I would put it as in general, yeah.
Well,
that's true.
Mm-hmm. They're such a good group, but you just go on their homepage. Let's see, homepage. Religious critic positive after West Point meeting. Is it a humanist military chaplain an oxymoron? Battle continues over religious freedom at military base. Conservatives dismiss overt defamation of non-believers. Charming. MRFF demands immediate end to unconstitutional religious tests and denigration of atheist/freethinking Marines. U.S. military document teaches atheism is a suicide risk. Lovely, isn't it? God's foreign policy, Christian Zionism. They're using coded language that refers to Christian Zionism yearning for a battle, which may come in the form of a nuclear holocaust. And the U.S. military has a problem with atheists.
So Susan, I need some clarification. You said in the military, if you go into the military now, volunteer and you go in, and you don't meet a certain level of the spirituality index on a test, you have to go to classes?
Hmm?
Christian classes?
Yes.
Certainly not Chair of Law. Certainly not Chair of Law classes.
Oh, well, he's probably heard the joke. What was it, South Carolina? They stuck an I think it was an anti-abortion law, together with Sharia law being unconstitutional in North Carolina. Like, either one was necessary.
Well, you know, one thing I think is, I mean, it's always been the rule, but I think now, probably for us as generally somewhat older people, Susan exempted, but is to push that young people know that they can speak up and they do have a choice. Because I think that young people that are out there now in schools and other situations are a little bit less apt to be herded or railroaded than maybe they were when we were in school. And if someone said, this is the right thing, so you have to do it, almost everybody could click into some point of, this is the right thing to do, go do it. But I think in general, young people are a little bit braver about saying, no, this is a part of who I am, this is a part of my life. Marianne went on a trip with school. It was just supposed to be a trip to go to this place, and got there and found out that the people that took them on the trip were required that, you know, Sunday morning that they go to this church service, which lasted for hours, and they wanted to have daily prayer and all these things. And she said it was very uncomfortable for a large number of Asian and other exchange students that were on this trip, that there was definitely this, they felt very out of place and very uncomfortable, and that they were being forced to do stuff they didn't want to do. But, you know, so she was trying to lead a little rally band to say, no, we don't want to do this. But I do think that young people are a little braver at doing that now, maybe standing up and not quite so easily signing something or agreeing to something. I don't know if at the high school or the grade school level, but I think it's one really important thing is to teach kids is that
they are getting there, but there's tremendous backlash. You probably heard about the case of Jessica Alquist, where she basically set up a lawsuit because her school had a banner with religion on it, and she's heavily ostracized in her hometown. She even went to school in a different location. When atheist organizations were trying to send her flowers, they had to go to a different town.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be very dependent on, you know, where you live and what kind of support system you have.
And then, I mean, all the names they called it, nothing really had to do with this topic at hand. They would use any swear words up the wazoo that had absolutely nothing to do with the topic at hand. Pretty much just made to hurt her. Mikey Weinstein, who's the Military Freedom from Religion Foundation, he has to, when he goes on speaking engagement, he has to have a security guard because he's had so many death threats. So it's really hard to face these sort of things.
Susan, I'm wondering if you've read any interviews of scientists, credit or not, high-flying scientists. I alluded to Al's comment about scientific method being downplayed, and don't believe it. And I'm wondering if you've read any interviews of top, quote-unquote, top scientists who go that route. You know, I still believe in a conservative foundation, although I am a scientist doing a lot of experiments. Does that make any sense? Somebody who does bona fide research, but still, at the end of the day, has conservative ideas that seem to flaunt his scientific expertise.
Oh, there's a number of scientists who managed to separate the two positions.
Yeah.
Completely.
I find that fascinating. I can't quite understand
that dichotomy.
Yeah, that dichotomy. You spend your life going for tangible evidence, but yet, at the end of the day, I'm still concerned with Christian in heart.
I
you can juggle those things in your brain.
I think human beings are very good at analyzing.
Yeah, right.
And then some of them, you don't know which to believe. I mean, there's like, it's not on the topic, but there's like four either scientists or doctors who are now senators or congressmen up there who are some of the biggest climate change deniers. And it's hard to believe with them, whether it's because they're supporting their donors or whether they actually are swallowing the stuff left, right, and forward.
This is an issue we made it into in the Denver program, which is things that we set for Ken Haydock leading a program on Neil deGrasse Tyson, and what he has to say about scientists and how they managed to take outlier positions on religion, whereas the great majority apply the scientific method to religious beliefs. I guess we're at the end.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.